so nice, so that's what I like. Is that
I stand it here, hot, and you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show. Every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on 5Live.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here, and we're welcoming Mr. Charles Wright. This is our new season of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B, and Mr. Wright is one of the pioneers and is an R&B icon in the music industry. You've heard of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, which he fronted. And they have a very interesting history going way back. And we're honored to have them on our show today. Mr. Charles Wright, how are you doing, sir?
I'm pretty good. You?
Good, good. This is an honor, first of all, for me to even be speaking to you. I don't want to put an age thing on this, but as a teenager, I boogied to your record. Okay. And to grow up, and turn around and be interviewing a man, this is really an honor. That's all I can say. So let's get right on into it. The way we do it on our show, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B, is we let our guests just start from the very beginning, where they were born, how they grew up, what got them into music, their music, musical heroes and idols. And so start back in the very early days where you were born and where you came from before you even got into music. So we want to know your whole history. Charles Wright.
I presently have a book out called Up From Where We've Come. And it starts out sort of like this. It says, for those of you who don't know, I wrote a book. And it's all about my life. And believe it or not, it started 3 months before I was born. I explained this to my parents, who couldn't understand how I experienced such a thing 3 months before I was born. But I remember someone knocking on our door to tell my mother that my grandfather had got killed while walking up the railroad tracks, a box of groceries on his head.
Wow.
So, as I was trying to explain, I remember what we had to eat that day. We had baked yams. All right, said my mom. So how did your mama cook them yams? She thought she had me cornered. I bet you he won't be guessing up on that one any time soon, she told my father. In the fireplace, I said, because that's where she cooked them. And she hadn't cooked yams like that since my grandfather died because she didn't want to remind my father of the incident. But my father, so that's my very beginning as far as I can go back. From then on, I was my father's greatest fan, actually, and I helped him do all the things. Pardon me?
Who was the greatest fan of who?
I was the greatest fan of my father.
Okay, your father's greatest fan. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I followed him around, and you know, on the weekends he had stuff to do around the shack. I'd be there helping him all the time. And actually, he thought I was going to grow up to be a great cotton picker because I had a sister that picked cotton better than my father, my mother, anybody. And he needed a counterpart for her, and he thought I was going to be the one. And I begged him to take me when the family leaves the house to go to the cotton patch, take me to the cotton patch. But he said, no, you're not old enough. Finally, when I got to be 6 years old, he took me out there, and he dumbed me with a gunny sack, and I was going to outpick everybody. After about 10 minutes, I realized. Yeah, it was so
bad. 6 years old. What state is this? What state is this, sir, that you were born in?
Mississippi Delta, where the blues was born.
That's cotton country and blues country. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, yes. So anyway, I hated it with a passion. I really disappointed him because he thought I was going to like be my sister's counterpart. And from that day forward, he and I split up, parted. We parted ways. It was like he had him for me. He whipped me every day. I didn't get 100 pounds, and I never could get 100 pounds.
So wow.
So it got to be that kind of relationship. Even after we moved to the city, I was 12, he had a habit of whipping me.
Wow.
Yeah. Then I decided I wanted to sing rock and roll. Well, what did I do that for? The guy that he was working for, who was his sharecropping partner back home, man who owned the land, he had convinced my father that all African-based music was the devil's music.
Wow.
Especially the blues, so we weren't allowed to listen to it. I wasn't allowed to sing it or say even try.
Let me ask you something about that, because that's insight that very few people have nowadays, of a time period when race music, black music, and the blues, which is all of this, which is later embraced by American society and the world. But there was a moment in time when it was considered, like you're saying, the devil's music.
It still is in a lot of places, trust me.
Mm. Wow.
Actually, they've killed it on the radio because they're trying to steal it, so they killed it. And and it ushered us all into the church. The only way we can hear the real deal now most of the time is we have to go into church to hear.
Okay.
So our music has been assassinated.
What was it at that time that drew you into that music, and where did you start learning to play?
Well, I started going to junior high school, I would be walking home from school, and all these kids would be singing all these songs, you know, from the Clovers and all these other groups and stuff, and I had never heard. So I found out where they was hearing it. They was listening to this show called the Hunter Hancock radio show, where this man played the greatest black music as it became on the market every week.
Wow.
So I started listening to that every time I could. I couldn't listen to it at home. But I loved it so much, I started buying the records.
And
I would carry a stack of records around me and with me. And when if I went to a friend's house or a relative who could listen to this music, I would have them play my records. That's how I got involved. I started playing. My sister taught me these four basic chords on the piano. We had no piano in the house we moved in on 23rd Street. So I learned those, and then after that I started trying to put two and two together as much as I could to learn more, teach myself more and more, because I never had a lesson.
Wow.
Yeah, so then I heard Jesse Belvin. I don't know if you know who Jesse Belvin is, but everybody
should. Yes, sir. The newer generation don't, but you can explain who he was to them.
He's the greatest thing that ever happened in Los Angeles. He's the backbone of all of them. But I heard him sing a song called One Little Blessing on the radio. I loved his voice so much. I called him up. I found his phone number in the phone book, and I called him a few times. I finally got it. Mr. Belvin, I said, I want to learn to sing, and I want to sound just like you. He gave me the best advice anybody ever gave me. He said, get your own style, boy, and leave mine the F alone.
Oh, wow. But that's good advice. But at the time, how did that impact you?
Well, you know, I said, oh, but I thought that'd be a compliment. He said, you ever hear Johnny Ace? I said, yes, I heard Johnny Ace. I like the way he sings too, but your style, you got. He said, well, you don't get it by now, boy, I'm hanging up. I said, oh, no, please. I said, I don't know what y'all doing out here, but I want to be a part of it. And I just don't know how to get started. I just was hoping you'd give me some pointers. And he was gracious enough to tell me, he said, there's a group called the Turks. They had hit records on the radio at the time. He said, I'm rehearsing with the Turks on Saturday, 2 o'clock at my house. He said, you can come over and listen, but keep your mouth shut.
Wow.
So I went over there, man, and by the time I left there, you couldn't have pried me away from this business. I had such a
That was it.
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Wow.
So I got with two of my cousins and another guy and started a vocal group. Because that's what everybody was doing in them days. It wasn't people.
And this is Los Angeles.
Los Angeles in the mid-50s. There was not a lot of gangs and fighting each other and stuff. It was harmony. Everybody was practicing harmony. They had glee clubs in the school, and they had groups breaking away from the glee clubs, and they had lots of groups. Even the first day I went to high school, there was about 4 groups on campus that had hit records on the radio.
Wow.
They were getting cheated out of the money, but everybody was trying to do the same thing. Everybody was trying to get harmonized.
Right.
I mean, we stand on the street corner harmonizing, and we go down in the tunnel and harmonize. We go in the bathroom at school and harmonize. It was about harmony, about killing each other and shooting each other.
Right, right.
Yeah,
man.
And you could walk down the street, man, and your mama be cooking. You could smell the food cooking out as you walk past, and Brooke Benton and Donna Washington and Jesse Belvin and the Turks and the Penguins and all these people be playing on the radio or on their record players. And the whole family would be in there. They wouldn't be out in the street looking for friendship or companion or family ship, they all be there waiting for their beans to get ready.
Wow. Also, Central Avenue was the central gathering point for black people at that time, wasn't it, with the nightclubs?
No, it was gathering for white folks, really. They had all the black best back talent in the world playing down there in them clubs.
Uh-huh.
Some of them were black clubs, but the major ones were. I came here on the cutting edge of that when I got here. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I never went down there, to be honest. But people that when I grew up and started hiring musicians, I had to hire those guys that was used to work down there, and they used to sit up. After the gig, I sit in the car at night sometimes at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, them telling me stories about what happened down there. We had a black union at the time, a black musician union, and the black guys were getting all the best jobs. And the people in Beverly Hills, they wanted the real thing at their parties, and they were hiring black musicians. And this guy who was running the union, he wanted to merge so bad with white folks, they wouldn't let him merge with the white union. And finally, when they decided, okay, we're going to let you merge. And they just started destroying black musicians and putting a white musician in place. Matter of fact, when I first started playing in nightclubs, I'm skipping a lot because I had three hit records with doo-wop groups before the Watts Band was even thought of.
Right.
But when I first started playing in clubs and with a band, my union representative used to come to the club. I had it happen to me 3 or 4 times that I know about. and my yacht representative would come to the club and tell the club owner, why don't you fire this band, hire a nice white band.
Wow. Just like, yeah. Just straight out like that.
Yeah. Huh. And it, now it's been got to the point to where we can't do nothing if we ain't got a white musician in the band to watch us. We can't do nothing. Most of the time, we can't even get the gigs because white bands are getting them.
Wow. Well, let me take you back. Let me take you back to Magnificent Monarchy and KGFJ Radio. You mentioned you were with a few other bands and the Wax 103rd Street Rhythm Band concept came along. But the Magnificent Monarchy episode was the beginning of that association of that name. Now, Mr. Fred Smith, is it true, the story goes, that he created the name Wax 103rd Street Rhythm Band and writing a song for the Magnificent Monarchy, everybody probably doesn't know by now, but KGFJ Radio was the only radio station in Los Angeles back in the day, 50s, 60s, on up, and Magnificent Monarchy was a very popular radio personality on that station. And his theme song was talking about, if I'm correct, and Mr. Charles Wright will correct me, it was called Spreadin' Honey. But that was the beginning of, can you explain how the Wax 103rd Street, if I'm correct, Mr. Fred Smith created the name, hired you to play on it, how did that come about?
Fred Smith was a producer. He produced groups like the Olympics, Hully Gully, and Dance of the Night of the Moon, and Harlem Shuffle by Bob and Earl.
Wow.
Another record called The Duck, which I played on too, by Jackie Lee. And unfortunately, he was hooked on the horses. But Fred produced a Montague needed a theme song, wanted a theme song for his show. So Fred produced Spreadin' Honey. Which had Leon Hayward, Bobby Womack, myself, and Abraham Mills, and a few people on it.
Bobby Womack.
Yeah, yes. And after the song became, the theme song became so popular that they wanted to make it a record to dance to.
Right.
So it was long enough, so they made a record. Fred put a record out on his label, Keeman Records.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave it the name of Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, which was an ingenious name in a way. That's okay. In a way. Montague put it out on his label as the Soul Runners.
Huh.
Montague.
Same track, though. It was the same track with you guys
same
playing
track,
on
yeah,
it.
Montague was an old partner of mine, but he was very unethical.
Okay.
Okay, so he capitalized off it that way. All right, so.
Right.
Now, then Fred, one day, I used to play in the studio all the time. I was a studio musician at that time. And Fred came in the studio one day while we were recording with somebody. He came in and brought Bill Cosby in there with him.
Wow, Bill Cosby.
Yeah, Cosby was looking for a band to back him up on his first singing album. No,
wow.
his first singing single.
Okay.
And so they were enjoying themselves so much listening to us that they stayed all day. When they left, they said, "You the guys we want to use to do this."
Wow.
So they came back. Actually, I didn't come back. Next 2 weeks later, I got a call from James Carmichael, who was arranging the session for Bill's first single. And so we did a track. We had Stevie Wonder's Uptight track. We didn't do the track. We redid the song.
Right. Okay.
With Bill Cosby rapping on top of it, a song called Little Old Man.
Oh.
And it became a smash. But so that when we did that, they put the, he wanted to use the name of Watts Hunter and Third Street Rhythm Band. For that. So then Bill wanted my band to become his backup band whenever he performed.
Wow, man.
So we also, okay, before that, he came back and we did an album called Silver Throat.
Okay.
And then we started performing behind him as a backup band. Then,
now let me just interrupt you right there. That association with Bill Cosby led Warner Brothers to sign you guys. I hope I'm not jumping too far ahead, but put me in my place if I am. To sign you guys as the first Warner Brothers Records, first R&B band, the association with Bill Cosby. Is that correct, sir?
No, he had James Brown and Bobby Bird and Ike Turner and Tina Turner and Warner Brothers had tried for about 15 years with a lot of acts trying to break into the R&B business, but we're the ones. So,
okay.
Yeah, but they couldn't break into it, so when they signed us. And when they signed us, Fred still was producing the music.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just producing these instrumental tracks, which were the Beatles songs and shit, stuff like that.
And okay.
And then they would send us out on the road to promote them.
Mm.
And we go out there, and we got a lot of disrespect from the disc jockey and stuff because they didn't think nothing of our music. Then they see us.
Wow.
They say, well, after we performed, they say, what the hell are you sending us disc jockey for? I mean, why are you guys... So I'm writing this in my new book now, my next book. I approached Fred and said, let me record some of the music with my band. So one day he decided, okay, come on. We went in the studio and started playing. He came over to PA, man. Get these son of a bitches out of here, excuse my expression. Y'all can't ain't nothing. Get out of here then and just kill my band spirit, you know.
Why? So, why did he do that?
That's the way Fred was. I mean, I've been on session with Fred before then. We'd be playing, and he'd tell the drummer, hold it. I want you to play this when you get to this part. Ding, da, da, ding, 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 boom, boom. We get there, the drummer plays whatever he plays. Oh, you stupid son of a gun, I didn't tell you that. And the whole session would fall apart because all of me was
with the, depressed.
He's very emotional. So anyway, there's a guy in Chicago named Bill Haverson. When we went on the road, every time we go out there, he would be, Warner Brothers had him taking us around to our radio station.
Okay.
And he knew what the band could really do, and he loved me. So he had talked to the president of the company and told him he should talk to me and Fred. So he called a meeting, and we went in there, you know, and the president said, you know, why don't you let Charles produce a couple of things on himself and everything? And Fred said, screw this whole thing. Give me $3,000 and I'm out. I said, are you crazy, man? $3,000? That ain't nothing. Give me $3,000. All he was thinking about was playing the horses, I think.
Oh, okay.
And I said, no, no, Fred. No, no. Don't do that, Fred. Don't take that. President of the company called his secretary and said, write a check for $3,000 for Fred right away. I said, no, don't do this, Fred. But he took the check, and he sold the name, actually, to the president of the company.
Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band?
Yep.
Okay. And what year was this, sir?
This was like 67, 66. Because right after that, you know, I had the company to back a truck up to the club we was playing in. That's when we did Do Your Thing, live.
Okay, up in Hollywood.
Yeah. And that's when our record sales really started becoming monumental.
Let's jump to that. You're playing, you're gigging at a club which was very popular on Hollywood and Vine, if I remember.
That's right.
And so you're doing a session. What inspired you to record the live session, which later became, like, was it your first hit record?
Yeah, the first million seller.
Okay, how did that come about? How did you? Who inspired? Who thought about? Hey, let's record this and release this. Let's do this with this live track. Where did that come from?
James Brown live at the Apollo Theater. You know, I wanted to do something like that.
Ah, okay.
So that's why I talked Warner's in the back in the truck up to the club we was working in.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually the first couple of sets, the band was very nervous. All those microphones sitting up there. And finally, the third set, we did an Otis Redding tune, and then we did Dyke and the Blazers, Funky Broadway. And then I broke the band down and just started, I'm looking out on the floor, and everybody out there looked like they dancing a different dance. And I coined that phrase, "Do Your Thing."
Right there on the stage.
Yeah, and I made it up, and then I took took it home and cut it off that tape out of that part, and took it home and had the band rehearsal the next couple of days. And I let the band hear it, and nobody wanted me to put it out.
Wow. Okay.
Some of the guys asked me not to associate their name with it. This is honest, true.
Oh, man.
I knew what I felt when we was doing it. So.
Okay.
So I put it out anyway. And nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. Eight months later, I get a call from a disc jockey named Georgie Woods in the Philadelphia. Hey, man, why don't you come down? I want you to star on my show. I star on your show? What show? I got a show this weekend. I mean, whatever weekend he asked for. Said, I want you to come star on it. I said, well, who's on the show? He said, Ruth Brown, Chuck Jackson, all these people that are already were my heroes. I said, kidding me. I said, hey. He said, you got the hardest record. I said, what record? He told somebody, he said, he don't even know. He said, do your thing. Number two here with a bullet. Number two. I said, wait a minute. Let me call you back. I'll call you back in a few minutes. So make sure you call me back so I'll call the company. I called this guy at the company I was dealing with, Clyde Bikima. I said, man. He said, man, that guy pulling your leg. We stopped following that record 3 months ago. It's dead. You better get something else new to put out there, Charles.
Wow.
I said, but that sounds like he's serious. He said, man, that guy's pulling your leg, man. We know what's going on here. I said, at least you could check and see what you're talking about, what he's talking about. He said, all right, I'll call you back in 15 minutes. 5 minutes later, I can't believe it, man. This record is sold 92,000 records in Philadelphia alone. It's unheard of. I said, see, you guys ain't on your job. He said, well, it could be just a Philadelphia record. I said, nah, people are everywhere, man. That record is a smash. He said, well, I'm going to give E. Rodney Jones 10,000 pieces and see what he does, because he'll play it if he can sell it in the shop. And the rest is history. It became a big hit, and it started going way up in the charts, and then, you know, name Watts, the people in the business didn't really want their name to rise, so they kept dropping it out of the chart. It would be number 67 this week with a bullet. Next week it's out of the charts. I go to Clive Akimo and say, man, listen, what's happening? He said, we sold more records than we did last week. I don't know what's going on. So he has to call Bill Woodboy and ball the people out, and they put it back in the charts. And it go up and it drop out again. The next thing you know, the Isley Brothers, they right there in Teaneck, New Jersey. They've been listening to Do Your Thing for a long time. So they cut It's Your Thing, which they told me later they got off of Do Your Thing. And
wow.
They started going up in the charts, and them and us started seesawing. But the thing about it is Do Your Thing was in the charts longer than any record that year. It was in the charts 27 weeks.
Wow.
It finally made it up to 11. I know it was number one, but they ain't gonna let us. They never would let us get beyond 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's Do Your Thing. Now, how did the blending of the Charles Wright and Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band come together? From that record?
Uh-huh. What do you mean?
Okay. In other words, after the record becomes a hit, the same guys who didn't want to have anything to do with it, now I assume they're coming back on board because they got a hit record. Was it the same group of guys?
Yeah, we had been together 5-6 years already. I've been grooming them.
Okay.
They were some bad summer guns, but they couldn't hear. We used to play top 40 all the time, so they couldn't hear nothing new. They did the same thing. One of them wouldn't even. I had to do Loveland about 40 different days because he kept messing it up because he thought it was a piece of junk. And finally one day I picked him doing it right. And they hated it. When I did Express Yourself, I wouldn't take him in the studio because he was always messing up, so I took just the drummer and myself in there and made a track. I brought it home. And I let the horn players hear. I want them to play on it. They said, man, we don't want to play on this junk. This ain't nothing but a piece of junk.
Wow.
I had to threaten them, tell them, man, I'm going to go get some of my studio partners and we're going to have some fun. And they grumbled and they played it. Came a hit. They put dark glasses on and couldn't see their eyes anymore. The group started actually. Here I pick up some guys, man, some nightclub musicians, and I had to con them to go as far as we did because they didn't believe. And every time we were out of a gig, they would go and get another kind of job or something. I tell them, man, come on back, we're going to do this, we can do this. Because I'd been out there with them three vocal groups. I knew what the possibilities were.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger they got, the less they were able to handle it, I think.
Wow.
And, this guy, because I wanted to be like Count Basie. I wanted to be going this day. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because we really were so bad, to be honest with you. We were on a Temptations tour, and this is the honest God truth. They could not follow us. They couldn't follow us. When they get through, people were probably, most of them gone home.
So 35, man.
Yeah.
Man. My producer,
everywhere a step for every note almost. We've been doing it in that club for 2.5 years before we went out there.
So you were tight.
Yeah, we were tight. So okay. The Temptations and everybody else set out to destroy us. And we went for it because we had a couple of jealous guys in the band, so didn't need a whole lot of help to do that.
Wow. Mr. Charles Wright, on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B, giving us history, dope history too, on the early days of R&B and the evolution of Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. So now, you got hit records coming out, you know, do your thing. Tell us about Express Yourself. That's the one, everybody is Loveland, you've had quite a few hits, but Express Yourself is the one that really touches people. How did that song come about, sir?
Well, you know, we were doing Do Your Thing one night at Texas A&M College.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Do Your Thing comes to an abrupt end. And once it ended, the kids kept stomping, and they kept clapping and stomping. And I don't know what made me say it. I said, "Express yourself."
It still touches me, man. Okay, I was one of them teenagers back then, dancing to that record.
They were that. And was crazy. I said a few other times, I tried to make the song up right there like I did Do Your Thing, but it just didn't happen, you know. So I shut the band down after a while, and I went to the hotel, and I sat down and started writing. I knew that it was an effective phrase. And I got off of a plane the next day about noon, and I had finished the lyrics, and I went home and started working on my guitar, on the rhythm, on the bass pattern and guitar rhythm and stuff. And went to the studio. Actually, I went a couple of times with the other guy, Al McKay, but he wouldn't play it right, so I went to the studio.
Al McKay.
Yeah.
Al McKay, who later went on to Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Right.
Man, okay. He played with Charles Wright in the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, was part of your band before there ever was an Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah, I'm responsible for Earth, Wind, and Fire. I don't say that too often. But
let's hear that. Let's hear that story, Mr. Wright, please.
It ain't no big story itself, but what I taught him, he interjected with them. He did it right with them. But many times he would rebel against me. I didn't know why he was rebelling against me and doing all the wrong stuff from time to time until 5 years after the band had broke up. He told me that James Gatson, who was the oldest guy in the band and who was one of the most jealous factors in the band, was always urging him to do something against me.
Wow.
So Al was a very good musician, but I taught him all this rhythm stuff because wasn't nobody playing this rhythm stuff that I play. Except for a guy named Adolf Jacobs, who I learned it from, but he'd only play it in a blues idiom. I put it all through the pop music and everything.
Right.
And that's what Earth, Wind, and Fire does. And I have to say this. I say I'm responsible, but I say this much. Earth, Wind, and Fire is the best group that ever set foot up on this planet. They
got
more than Beatles and Elvis Presley and everybody put together. 11 platinum records, triple platinum records for, triple platinum records for 11 straight years. That's a hell of a lot of progress.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah,
okay.
Ain't nobody done that. And nobody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So, Mr. Wright, you Express Yourself explodes, okay, and you're touring all over the world. Now, the record industry at that time, we're talking not in the 70s, R&B was beginning to rule, and then you had, I don't call Motown sound R&B, but, you know, Motown sound did help black music, left us black music, and R&B. Now, R&B, at the time, going through some changes in the 70s. You had the disco era coming in. How did that affect the type of music that you were making at the time as things started to change in the 70s?
Listen, man, nothing ever really changes.
Yeah.
I mean, except names, categories. Okay? They have to keep us in these boxes to control us. They have to keep us in these boxes to keep us from taking over American pop music. We are American pop music. Everything that you hear is copied from what we do. We do gospel, blues, and soul. All of that is the same thing.
Okay.
They change the name just like they change the name of our race periodically. Mm-hmm. To keep us confused and keep us split up from each other. I come home and tell my mama, I'm no longer a Negro. I'm black. And she gets insulted, you know, because calling somebody black in her ear was a big insult.
I remember that transition during the 60s when there were a lot of people who were insulted of being called black. I'm a Negro. Yeah. You would hear that. I'm a Negro. I ain't black. I remember when the Afros first started popping up, you would hear that from a lot of older black people. I'm saying older because at the time I'm part of the young generation. I'm 18, 19. I'm my first Afro. You know what I'm saying? Black power, right on, all of that. And the society is changing. And did that affect you? You said nothing ever really changes. And that's, first of all, I got to give you respect for being a very intelligent brother, because the statement that you just made, which had nothing to do with music at all, is very insightful. So I can see that you're a very deep thinker, and I can understand how success was destined to come your way. But you've written a book, Up From Where I've Come,
from where we've come,
and tell us about the inspiration for the book. We've covered basically your musical career up through the 70s, but I'm sure there's a lot more to follow because you're still here, sir, but I'm sure the book captures most of that. So tell us, basically go into Up From Where We've Come and what was the inspiration and what you hope to accomplish.
Well, fact of the matter is, not just our people, but all Americans are deprived of our true history. And I figured I lived a part of American history that should have been documented. And this part is only up until I'm 12 years old. And it has to do with got a lot. It's 57 different stories, actually, of what I went through and my family went through growing up in the southern cotton patch in Mississippi. And trust me, if you don't know, you can't go no further until you know where you come from. And that's why I wrote this book. So these people walking around here, I know they ain't going to read it with their pants hanging down off their butts. The people who are dealing with these fake TV shows and comedians who calling each other niggas and calling women out of their name.
Yes, sir.
They need to get some real substance under their belt so they can tighten their belts up and move on. We've been stagnated here in this place for eons. We got to start making sure our children get education, because they're not. And they ain't even playing in the education. I was watching this morning. Well, those people who talk about educating the children and about the guns in the school and everything, and everybody damn near was white, mostly blonde-headed. Ain't nobody thinking about our children. And I'm going to tell you, I sent my daughter to a school. I took my daughter because I was living 35 miles away. Every day I took my to a school called Marcus Garvey School in L.A. And let me tell you, they have PTA meetings, and it would be my wife and me and another couple there.
Ain't
no black folks ever showed up for their children in this. This is supposed to be a black country school.
That's sad.
Yeah,
that's very sad.
But we got to start making sure our kids get an education and supporting our kids, you know. And
yes, sir.
Yeah, and they need to know this stuff here that's in my book. Everybody needs to know this stuff that's in my book. So, and you read my reviews on Amazon, I'm getting all 5-star reviews.
Wow.
Ain't nobody out there trying to sell my book because it's probably the exact thing that they don't want people to know. Fact of the matter is, what we did then, we did the slave work. I was from a sharecropping family. That's the next step after slavery. And they got now they have chemicals they plant with the cotton. They don't need anybody to go out there and chop the cotton. Because nothing will grow but cotton. They got machines to pick as much as 5,000 black folks a day. So now they don't need us anymore. And if you go back to the country, go back home, you find a whole bunch of black people sitting around with nothing to do, waiting on some welfare, killing each other over dope, and we're stagnated. So
yes, sir. But let me tell you,
we're not aware of this.
No, but let me tell you, people like you, sir, are a bright light amongst all of this. His book, Up From Where We've Come, I've got a copy right here. The author of the hit song Express Yourself, Mr. Charles Wright, An Eventful Journey. We want you to, my audience, to get out there on the internet. And also, you have CDs. Is your music available on the internet?
My website is expressyourself.net.
Okay.
And you can order music there if you want it or whatever.
And the book? You can order the book also?
You can.
Okay.
You can order the book at Amazon and get it, probably get it easier and faster. Amazon.com.
Okay. And I've got some CDs here. I'm going to read the label, the latest. We've got Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Band, which is looks like a greatest hits LP with Express Yourself, Do Your Thing in Loveland. Then we've got Charles Wright. It's a solo album, Going to the Party. Then we have Charles Wright album, She Don't Believe in Love. And another Charles Wright album, Something to Make You Feel Good. So which is the latest and the greatest of these?
Something to Make You Feel Good.
Something to Make You Feel Good, Mr. Charles Wright. Okay. You can order it at Express, what was it, sir? ExpressYourself.com?
.net. Net.
.net.
ExpressYourself.net.
ExpressYourself.net. Okay. Mr. Charles Wright, we want to thank you, sir, for doing our show. We want to thank you for your contributions not only to R&B, but to music in general. You're an icon. And someone who basically has, up from where we've come from the cotton fields to the worldwide stage and the top of the charts, we've got to honor our people. We have to honor our icons and people like you. It was an honor for me to even interview you, and I'm glad you accepted my request. My producer, Robin Lynn Maben. Are you there, Robin?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I understand you have some questions from Mr. Wright. And Mr. Wright, I got to apologize to my producer because she wanted to be co-interviewer. But I started with so excited that I didn't bring her in the beginning. But she's here now.
She's
got some things to say. Go ahead.
He forgot all about me, sir.
I sure did, and I'm sorry.
Oh,
I apologize.
Maybe I ran my mouth too much.
No, sir. You've been dropping bombs, Mr. Wright, but go ahead, Rob.
It's such an honor speaking with you. I remember I was a little girl, and I was on the stage, and I was, everybody, get on the floor, do your thing. And my mama, I was like 5, 7 years old, but my mama was looking at me, and she was like, everybody.
All right.
Now, I want to ask you, sir, from being in music, back when they were still spinning the 45s and the 33 and the third RPMs, and all the way up to now, what do you think, or what are your views on social media and its impact on music?
Unfortunately, technology and the social media has destroyed the presence of music. We've gotten to the point today where you can steal the music instead of buying it, and I think that's not good. And also, the technology, the music today, it ain't music. Most of the music that's made today is an assimilation of music. And I think we need to get back to the real instrument. But the problem is, I love making it. I got a brand new album here now I just made that I love. But I don't know what to do with it, because if I put it out there on YouTube, it's free for all. And I don't mind it being free, except for it cost me a whole lot of money to make this music with real musicians.
I have the answer for that. So right now they have what you call streaming rights and neighboring rights, so that when other platforms are playing your music, you'll still collect your royalties. And I will get that information over to you after our interview, sir.
I appreciate it. Send it
at
any rate, but I know about streaming. I just have never experienced doing it. So you might be able to help me out in that area, but that's my plan. Is the only thing I can do with this album is I'm going to stream it. It might be my last album, but it's a beautiful album, and I want the world to hear it.
Yes, sir. Yes,
but
sir.
But I don't want to just give it away.
You have a title for it, sir? You have a title for the new album?
Yes, but I don't want to give that away.
And I agree with you, sir. Today you've got noise and sound being accepted and received, even winning awards for as music. Noise and sound. Yeah.
When we first started out, I was talking about harmony. That's what we had then, and since then, we got more distortion than we have anything, and that's the opposite of harmony, and that affects us mentally. That affects the world mentally, and basically, that's because everybody's trying to steal our music instead of letting the music flow.
Yeah.
And they come up with all kind of gimmicks and distortions and stuff, and the opposite to what it should be. You know, Lil Jordan started rock and roll, whether anybody wanted to give him credit or not, and simple and beautiful and very happy music. And that's what this is supposed to be.
What would you say words of encouragement are, even words of wisdom, to the young musicians and artists coming up today?
Well, I always have the same thing to say, but I don't know if nobody's listening, you know.
Go ahead.
We should make our music with real musicians and real instruments, because when you're making music otherwise, you're doing it to a click track, and it's precise. Every note is precise, And the human heart don't work that way. It fluctuates.
Huh.
And that's what makes music beautiful, when the human heart latches on to it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That might be deep for some people to understand.
No, that's very deep, sir. But it's real.
Here at Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B, we keep it real and we keep it deep.
I got a question for you also, sir, since you come from that era. Now, I know Little Richard, and if you listen to him, he's the Quasar of rock and roll. But there was also Ike Turner, and there was also Chuck Berry. Who, in your opinion, actually made the first rock and roll record?
Louis Jordan is the guy who created the difference between jazz and rhythm and blues. He's the one that brought it in.
How so, sir?
Well, go back and listen to him and look at his videos. He was before Little Richard and Chuck Berry and everybody. He was playing
that style of music, which later developed. Go ahead.
He's the one that invented the word rock and roll.
Wow.
Some disc jockey asked him on the radio, "What's this beautiful music you play?" He said, "A little rock and a little roll," and that's how he got his name.
Wow. Louis Jordan.
His words of wisdom.
Wow. Okay. And you're one of the few people I would even ask a question like that and respect the answer. I got to respect your answer, Mr. Charles Wright.
You better.
Yes, sir. You got anything else, Robin?
Well, I just want to say probably I'm not the only one, Mr. Wright, but your music and you make me so happy. Still do to this day. Still do. I mean, when I'm feeling myself and I'm making a major accomplishment, I'll be like, everybody, you're the man.
That makes it all worthwhile.
I really want to thank you on behalf of myself, and I know I'm not the only one. Just your music and you just make me happy, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. On my website, I did a half-hour interview with Little Richard about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's on the website. Check it out.
Cool. Mr. Charles Wright from the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. He's also an author now. Up From Where We've Come is his book. You've heard Miss Robin Lynn Maben from Vibe Live, and you check out her website also. She also has other radio programs besides mine that she produces. And I want to give out to King Charlie Prince, who she's managing now. But Mr. Charles Wright, again, we want to thank you. I really hate hanging up, sir, but we've got time restrictions on us. And when your second book comes out, you're writing another book, and you release this album, we're going to get you back on the show so we can help you promote your book. So you're still creative, and you got to be older than me. I'm 58. We don't have to get it. You obviously are still very much on top of everything. So we appreciate you, sir, and glad you're still around.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. All right. This has been Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B with Mr. Charles Wright from the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, and also the author of the new book, Up From Where We've Come. Peace. We out.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic. See you next week. Bye.